Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. We're forging ahead. The mid-1880s are here. So too is the scramble for Africa. There are many correlations and connections in this episode, so hang on tight as we toboggan down the slippery slopes of history, bumping into all manner of bizarre and simultaneously heinous characters. Keeping in mind that we're dealing with men and women of their age, nevertheless, the tale is one of intrigue, ego, treasure hunting, not to mention madness. Belgium, by 1882, was barely half a century old, becoming independent only in 1830, ruled by King Leopold I and then the Second, the latter who sported a spade-shaped beard and a giant colonial chip on his shoulder. Because he led a respectable European country, he was a king, but how he'd become a king was a sleight of hand. His father, Leopold I, was a German prince related to the British royal family. This trembling nation had been pasted together, an uneasy amalgam, as Adam Hochschild writes, of French and Flemish, a version of Dutch spoken in northern Belgium. King Leopold II was fluent in French and German, like his father, and later in English, but he never bothered to learn Flemish, spoken by more than half his people. A snob, some said bitterly, as bitter as the division created by language and class. French was the language of the bourgeois, the educated. Flemish was working class. Even the professionals in northern Belgium spoke French instead of Flemish, the perceived language of the farm labourer and factory worker. As a teen, Leopold II was a gangly youth, his head too big for his body, his clothes hanging off his spindly shoulders. A callow boy whose mother tended to write him threatening letters about his lack of interest in studies rather than speak to him directly. He was useless in most subjects, except for geography. Leopold II was a geography freak, and from the age of 10, his education was based in military law. By 15, he was a lieutenant of the Belgian army. 16, he was captain. 18, a major. 19, a colonel. And only a year later, at 20, a major general. This pencil-thin spindle of a boy had to apply for an audience with his father, who spoke to his son through messengers. As this alienated lad aged, he surrounded himself with men who explained how government worked and plied him with maps, his favorite things. His father summed up young Leopold as subtle and sly, he never takes a chance. He was like a fox, said Dad, Leopold I. It was this fox who was going to become a totalitarian ruler of a vast empire in Africa, the Congo, a place he would never visit. Like many other monarchs of the time, he was also terrified of sex. His loveless arranged marriage to Austro-Hungarian Habsburg Archduchess Marie Henriette was typical of the upper crust, because Leopold and Marie Henriette loathed each other at first sight. The wedding should have set off early alarms. Leopold got scarlet fever. Marie Henriette's train was late. During the honeymoon, the bride wept with frustration when Leopold refused to go on a gondola ride in Venice. When Marie Henriette laughed, it was described as the sound of a barnyard animal snorting, gasping, rasping in the town halls of Belgium during her introduction to the citizens, startling all who heard it. Later, she would write,
"If God hears my prayers, I shall not go on living much longer."
A bit goth, but you could perhaps understand her misgivings, because Leopold certainly was sinister. During a visit to England, Queen Victoria spoke to Marie Henriette about the birds and the bees. Her husband, Prince Albert, did the same with spindly Leopold. Apparently neither had ever been educated in the dark arts of procreation. Still, it took years, but eventually Marie Henriette became pregnant. Leopold wrote a letter to Albert, thanking him for the wise and practical advice, which the skinny Belgian lad said had no bon fruit. The marriage was miserable. Marie Henriette fled the royal chateau of Laeken to go on long horse rides while her king needed his maps. When the elder Leopold died, Leopold II exclaimed, "Petit pays, petit gans," small country, ordinary people. Belgium, just for the record, is about the same geographic size as Lesotho and squeezed between France and Germany, the grand nations of Europe in the late 19th century. Leopold II was peeved by his puniness. Something had to be done to rouge up the petit pays. It's vital to throw our minds back to this time because, like all history, there are echoes today, often deadly. That is not exactly how you could characterize Count von Bismarck, the initial architect who steered Germany into the scramble for Africa. Chancellor Bismarck was not a royal, but he was a master of realpolitik, a ruthless, pragmatic approach to politics focused on national interest rather than moral ideas. Bismarck was calculating and stoic and initially dismissive of colonies, famously stating that his map of Africa lay in Europe. But the narrative of the day was to grow national power by seizing land wherever it could be found, and Africa was apparently awash with land. Most of it was not empty, despite what adventurers like Henry Morton Stanley were saying. Recognizing growing domestic pressure and the strategic need to split British and French alliances, Bismarck plunged Germany into the colonial race. In 1884, he hosted the Berlin Conference with a hazy goal of formalizing something about the European partition of the African continent. Dear listener, this is crucial stuff to understand what global events were going to shape South African history. When the Germans or the French sneezed, the British would flinch, and when the British flinched, Africa tore a cruciate ligament. The main aim of Berlin Conference was to deal with the growing pressure of European claims over West Africa, but it was much more than that. It began formally on Saturday the 15th of November 1884 as early winter snow arrived and cloaked Berlin. 19 diplomats, along with 15 assistants, representing 14 great and lesser powers, climbed the stairs to number 77 Wilhelmstrasse, into the grey fluted pilasters and coarse yellow bricks of Bismarck's house. They sat around a horseshoe-shaped table, Bismarck at the head. In a way, they'd replicated an earlier Congress, 1879, 6 years earlier, with its giants of the age. This time the representatives were mere diplomatic pygmies by comparison. Back in 1879, the conference was about who controlled the Orient and the East, where Russia grabbed great bits of the Ottoman Empire. Bismarck had then offered titbits like Tunis and Cyprus to the French and the British. But the British had messed up in 1884. They had tried to hand over the mouth of the great Congo River to the Portuguese under the very nose of the French and the Belgians, not to mention the Germans. So the plenipotentiaries had their brief. But what was Bismarck planning? Was this a free trade conference to safeguard German business in the Congo and Niger? Or was Bismarck about to wield a hefty cake slicer to carve up the whole African continent? The 14 diplomats represented Russia, Austro-Hungary, America, along with Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Holland, Belgium, amongst others. At this conference, Britain, despite its large formal African empire, including South Africa, and even larger informal empire where the sun never set, was more vulnerable than it looked. The British had just lost Cameroon, Togo, and Angra-Pequen, which is now known as the Namibian port town of Lüderitz. More about that at the end. France was Germany's ally in 1884, but the French representative was nervous. They were the world's leading protectionist state, France was, and Bismarck could possibly be planning a free trade push at this conference. Portugal was there, half senile as an empire, three quarters bankrupt, hoarding her ancient possessions in Africa, like Angola and Mozambique. Lisbon was also protectionist. They too believed Bismarck was aiming to break their monopoly. More vulnerable than all was Leopold II's International Association of the Congo. This state had not even been invited. Was Bismarck planning to steal it from under the skinny Belgian king's nose? Bismarck stood, welcomed all at 2 p.m., and addressed the gathered diplomats in French. He seemed curiously uncertain as he spoke of the three C's, commerce, Christianity, and civilization. It was time, he said, to also discuss three other goals: free trade for the Congo, the vast heart of Africa, as well as free navigation on the Niger River, an agreement on the future annexations of territory, rules that should govern the cutting up of Africa. In short, they were going to decide on the rules for the scramble, but not actually carve up the continent at that moment. Then Bismarck sat down, much to the surprise of the delegates and everyone else who read the newspapers later. One of the surprised readers, sitting in his grand home in Belgium, was Leopold II, who had nervously awaited word from Berlin as the representatives jostled and plotted. The first reports were more positive than he hoped. The Belgian monarch had indulged in an epic conspiracy. His delicate task was to pull the carpet from under the Portuguese, whose treaty with Britain threatened to block the mouth of his Congo River. His second hoodwink, and this was a biggie, was to convince all the powers of Europe that they should recognize his blue flag with a single golden star as one of a sovereign state. Leopold's fellow conspirators included a 61-year-old American aristocrat from Connecticut, whose mother's family were founding members of the entire state itself, a free-wheeling ex-diplomat who'd been sent by Abraham Lincoln as U.S. ambassador to Belgium, and a Florida citrus and property developer, self-styled General Henry Sanford. He'd never been a soldier, but everyone called him General, a bit like Colonel Sanders of Kentucky Fried Chicken fame. In the latter case, Sanders had been in the army, but only as a lowly private, never a colonel. Leopold had schmoozed Sanford, and nothing titillates a fake American general more than being schmoozed by European royalty. By now, Leopold's Congo ambitions had seen his other lackey, Henry Morton Stanley, helping to set up 17 stations throughout the Congo. There were no less than 7 Belgian steamers sailing back and forth on the Congo River, and Sanford was sent to America holding a letter from the Belgian king. Leopold claimed he was expanding the civilizing influence of Christianity over the Congo, while simultaneously ensuring free trade. Its constitution, he said, would be modeled on that of the United States of America. The International Association of the Congo, i.e. the King of Belgium, was going to magnanimously hand that country back to the world as a free state later. Of course, he was going to do nothing of the sort. Leopold wanted to suck every last thing of value out of the Congo, like a wasp born inside a paralyzed spider. Lincoln was long gone, assassinated. It was American President Arthur who accepted the King's letter in early December 1885. The President was easily fooled, so too Congress. They backed Leopold's claims. Now he had to ensure that the Portuguese did not block the Congo River. He needn't have worried. Soon the great powers of Europe were roaring their disapproval of the Anglo-Portuguese agreement over the mouth of the great African river, and eventually, to cut a very long story short, the treaty was proclaimed dead in the water. Shortly after this, a revelation emerged. Leopold had told a few porky pies, claimed British Foreign Office sources. The three C's were nonsense, so too the free trade malarkey. The sources knew that the Belgian king's aim was simply to make money and create a gigantic trade monopoly behind the smokescreen of philanthropy and altruism. The Foreign Office, however, was unsure of the accuracy of these reports. Fortunately for Leopold, Bismarck of Germany began to suspect that this entire saga was really an attempt by France to take over the Congo. It must be prevented, and the German Chancellor approached Leopold with what you could call an offer that he could not refuse. Germany would recognize his claim to the Congo on condition that he guaranteed absolute free trade for all German nationals in the entire Congo basin, and secondly, that if he ever sold that territory to anyone, i.e. France, that he should arrange for the newcomer to give the same guarantee. After initially balking at the second condition, Leopold ate humble pie, and Bismarck reverted to gracious patron. The German, however, was up to no good. Behind Leopold's bony back, Bismarck had told the French ambassador Baron de Courcelles that he didn't expect the new state to survive, but it was useful for diverting troublesome rivalries. "Give Leopold his Congo," said Bismarck, "and he'd just muck it up. At least the other powers weren't fighting over Central Africa." That was the sentiment. So back to the Berlin conference. Bismarck had now secretly granted formal recognition for the Congo Free State and somehow Britain had to be induced to grant recognition too. The British had arrived at the conference with one main aim, to butter up Bismarck in order to fight off France's challenge for the Niger River and all territories adjacent. After some dithering in the British Foreign Office, a cable was sent to Berlin where the British formally recognized Leopold's right to the Congo. The Belgian king was still fretting about the French and Portugal, who may still lay claim to the mouth of that river. Bismarck was making up his own rules as this conference went along and tried to force France to accept that Leopold controlled the vast slice of Africa. For France, it was a bit of a shock, and they realized they'd been bamboozled by the Germans. Not for the first time, you could say, nor the last. They were now sharing the Niger River with Great Britain, but retained their control over the north bank of the Congo River. That became French Congo, with its capital at Brazzaville. But the Portuguese continued to demand the right to the Congo mouth in its entirety, and all the way inland to the crucial rapids. This kind of back and forth went on for 6 weeks, when French Ambassador Braun Courcel leapt up in late December, screaming across the conference hall with its horseshoe table at the German and British delegations. Non, prenez-vous pour les brigands? Do you take us for crooks? A series of diplomatic maneuvers followed for the next few weeks, and I will spare you the machinations other than to say that Bismarck was letting off steam by now, like a train kept too long in a siding. By the end of January 1885, the conference continued to be held up by those wretched territorial negotiations. The Germans bullied the Portuguese into a compromise as Leopold nimbly offered them more territory. They could keep the enclave at Cabinda in what is now northern Angola. Back in Lisbon, the Portuguese government were not going quietly. They still wanted the north bank of the Congo and the important port of Vivi on the south bank. Leopold's new port was going to be strangled. While Bismarck went apoplectic, a Portuguese gunboat captain quickly planted a flag at a town called Banana at the Congo River mouth. A quick-thinking British naval commander then removed it. By mid-February 1885, Leopold had managed to lever the mouth of the Congo out of Portuguese hands, and Germany had convinced the French that the territory of what would become Congo-Brazzaville was theirs in exchange for relinquishing their claims on the coast. The real target, though, for all of this to and fro was Great Britain. Germany, Portugal, France, the United States, virtually all of the nations at this conference wanted to cut London down to size. She was the greatest colonial power in the world, and a bit of a dog in the manger. Britain ran a long list of protectorates. She governed colonies across the globe, controlled most world trade. The conference was convinced by London that the rules of occupation of new territory should only apply to the coasts, where there was almost no new territory across Africa to be occupied by the Europeans. The British convinced Bismarck to exclude the protectorates, the main method of occupation adopted by London. And so the General Act of Berlin was signed on the 26th of February, 1885, to the collective sigh of relief of the assembled delegates. There were 38 clauses to the General Act, which, as Thomas Pakenham has pointed out, were as hollow as the pillars in the Great Saloon, or Donald Trump's arch de ego. Since then, the importance of the Berlin Conference has been debated by schools of historians. Some say the conference precipitated the scramble for Africa. Others believe it was the other way around. The race to grab a slice of the African cake had started long before the conference began, and none of the 38 clauses of the General Act had any teeth. But this conference did mark a turning point in the history of Africa and Europe. Colonials, you see, would waffle on about the spirit of Berlin. Missionaries like David Livingstone's lofty ideals to introduce the three C's to Africa, commerce, Christianity, and civilization. A commitment to humanism, but actually symbolized by three other C's, concession, cruelty, coercion. 1 million square kilometers of Central Africa were now in the hands of the Belgians. Leopold never set foot in Berlin during the conference, like he had never set foot in Africa. Back in South Africa, the reports and newspapers welcomed the agreement, believing that Leopold was indeed into free trade, and that British goods would be flooding into the Congo Free State, cotton goods, blankets, crockery, muskets, gunpowder, hardware of all kinds. The Leeds Mercury newspaper in Britain toasted good old King Leopold, a noble-minded sovereign. It was at this moment that terrible news emerged from the Sudan. Khartoum had fallen. General Gordon had been decapitated. The British government's entire North African policy was in tatters. Lord Salisbury and the opposition in Parliament saw their chance to bring down the government of Lord Gladstone. So did the French, who had gone to the Berlin conference as Anglophobes and emerged from the conference hating the British even more viscerally. They were Anglophobes in uppercase. If you followed the series, then you'd know that down south, the Boers were seeking to gain control of a port to cut out the British in Cape Town and Durban. Delagoa Bay was an option. The Germans, meanwhile, were openly boasting about discussing possible partnerships and ventures with the Suid-Afrikaanse Republiek. You can imagine how by now the British Foreign Office was beyond alarmed by the possibility that the Germans were going to take over parts of East Africa. There were reports that Berlin was snooping around the territory of the Amampondo, but it was in the West that opportunity would truly knock for the Germans. The story of Angra Pequena, or Small Bay in Portuguese, is one of the great turning points in the scramble for Africa. For centuries, this bleak, windswept stretch of the Namib Desert was ignored by major European powers. Before the 1880s, Great Britain dominated, except it hesitated to officially annex what is a vast and arid territory north of the Carib, the Orange River. These were expensive logistical burdens, although it did annex Walvis Bay further north and the nearby Penguin Islands to secure the best harbour and guano resources. This left Angra Pequena as a political loophole, unclaimed by any European power. In 1884, Bremen merchant Adolf Luderitz bought the bay and the surrounding land from local Nama chief Joseph Fredericks II. It is one of history's grand ironies that Imperial Germany secured its massive foothold in Southwest Africa through a transaction that was effectively a geographic swindle. Adolf Luderitz negotiated the purchase in geographical miles, a German unit four times longer than the English nautical mile that the local Nama chief assumed they were using, buying a sprawling territory the size of a European principality for 200 rifles and 2,000 marks, about $20,000 to $30,000 today. Chancellor von Bismarck had been skeptical of its value and then realized it was a massive strategic opportunity. Luderitz gave the newly unified German Empire a base right on the flank of the British Empire's Cape Colony. By establishing German Southwest Africa, it signaled that Berlin was now a global player capable of challenging British maritime dominance. The carving out of a German territory right on the flank of the Cape Colony, the occupation of Luderitz, had smashed Britain's undisputed monopoly on Southern Africa. This injection of intense European rivalries onto the subcontinent set off a high-stakes geopolitical scramble, permanently altering the region's borders and directly shaping the political destinies of all South Africans. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up to the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, auf Wiedersehen.